Hello, everyone, and welcome to this episode of Bardolatry. This month, or week, or episode, or whatever the heck, I never know what to call it, we are discussing Shakespeare's problem plays, those pesky plays that don't quite seem to fit into comedy or tragedy. So we'll be discussing Measure for Measure, Troilus and Cressida, and All's Well That Ends Well. Just as a reminder, I am Gabs.
I'm Olivia.
And this week we have a special guest star in Dr. Anthony Funari. Would you consider yourself a professor of Shakespeare, Anthony? Tony?
That's early modern drama, absolutely.
And I guess I should call you Tony instead of Anthony.
Whichever you prefer.
All right. So Tony is nice and agreed to be on the episode today to lend us a little bit of scholarly legitimacy, which we appreciate.
I'll do my best.
So I just thought today we would start the discussion with, like, what are the problem plays? Like, why are they considered a problem? And, yeah, can you just, like, give us a little, like, the history of that?
Sure. Well, okay. The idea of problem plays, or the term problem plays, wasn't something Shakespeare would have known or would have mentioned or wouldn't have called these problem plays. The term didn't come around until about 1896. There was this literary scholar named Frederick S. Boas. He actually coined the term, and he grouped certain plays. They were Measure for Measure, Troilus and Cressida, and All Well That Ends Well, and actually Hamlet, as problem plays. Now, the reason why they're called problem plays is because they actually don't conclude like they should. In other words, let's take, for example, Measure for Measure. It's classified as a romance, but no one actually really gets married at the end. Or All's Well That Ends Well, it's a forced marriage at the end. Or in Troilus and Cressida, it was classified as a romance, but, you know, where's the romance? So that's kind of one of the reasons why these are called problem plays, is that the expectations we have of them aren't fulfilled at the end.
What would all of these plays, like, so you said Troilus and Cressida was a romance. Is Measure for Measure considered a comedy?
Yes, it is. Measure for Measure is considered a comedy. All's Well That Ends Well, these were in the first folio that was published in 1620. This is how they were classified. So All's Well That Ends Well and Measure for Measure were considered comedies, and Troilus and Cressida was considered a romance.
Okay.
Or was labeled as a romance.
So why is Hamlet, why was Hamlet grouped in with those? Because I've always, and maybe this is just because it's so famous and we all know how it ends, but I always just accepted it as a tragedy.
Well, yeah, that's a really good point. If you think about it this way, in all these plays, what they have in common is the character director. So you have this character in there that's kind of manipulating the plot all along. So we see this in All's Well, Friends Well, That's Helena. In Measure for Measure, that's the Duke, right? In Troilus and Cressida, that's, you can actually have two characters there. That's Pandarus and Ulysses. They're kind of manipulating the plot to go along. And Hamlet does the same thing. He tries to manipulate the plot. But what we see in all of these is that all of them fail at doing this. So they're not able to get the resolution that they want. It's really a question, because if you look at the end of Hamlet, does Hamlet actually get the revenge he seeks? I mean, we have this bloodbath at the end. So the Frederick Boas, who, again, grouped Hamlet as a problem play, thought that this didn't actually give the type of resolution that a typical tragedy would give us. That sort of where the villain gets his comeuppance, in a way.
Okay. So even though, like, Claudius dies at the end of Hamlet, it's not really considered, like, proper revenge?
Right. I mean, there's a real question. Is Hamlet a successful revenge hero?
Well, I think he's kind of a whiny... argue maybe not.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah, it does make sense, but I would argue that every tragedy has a character trying to manipulate things that doesn't go his way. But I guess the difference here is that we're actually rooting for Hamlet, where we're not really rooting for Macbeth. His end is well deserved. Or in Julius Caesar, like, we sympathize with Brutus, but, you know, he gets what he deserves. It's good that, like, we can have a dialogue about this. I like that, you know, we can't put Hamlet into a clear-cut genre.
Mm-hmm. I mean, what's really kind of interesting about Hamlet, and not to get too much off the topic here, but Hamlet kind of deconstructs the whole genre of tragedy. I mean, we have here a character who questions his role as a revenge hero. Did he actually do this? And that's what Shakespeare does in the other problem plays. I mean, if you look at, again, a good one is All's Well That Ends Well. Here's a comedy that kind of questions what a comedy should be, how a comedy should end.
Mm-hmm.
Or even... in Measure for Measure, the resolution we get at the end here, there's a real question of, is this a satisfactory one?
Yeah, I think that's interesting because, like, what I've always heard is just a tragedy ends with people dying, and a comedy ends with people getting married. And if you just, like, go by that straight definition, Measure for Measure and All's Well That Ends Well kind of work. But then, yeah, if you're kind of using this other criteria as well, then... When I was reading them, I was like, I think they're just problem plays because when you read them, you just kind of feel like this doesn't work the same way that the other comedies I've read work. And
yeah,
so it just it feels very different.
Yeah. And if you look at the marriages at the end, I mean, if you take a look at marriage in Measure for Measure, it actually begins with a type of marriage. We see Claudio and Juliet.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to be married, but because they have fornicated and Juliet's now pregnant, they are being jailed and Claudio is probably going to be killed. But the marriages at the end here are all enforced. It's the Duke forcing Angelo to marry his former fiance. It's the Duke forcing Lucentio to marry that prostitute. And he almost enforces himself Isabella to marry him. So it's all about forced marriages.
Well, it's interesting with Isabella and the Duke's marriage because that's not something that, like, I remember when I saw Measure for Measure for the first time, that completely came from left field at the end because the whole time Isabella is trying to preserve her virtue and she spent so much energy fighting Angelo that the Duke's proposal at the end was just kind of like, what the what? And especially because she doesn't say anything. She doesn't actually consent or have any line past when the Duke asked her to marry him. It does leave the ending open to interpretation. Like, once my professor was telling me of an ending he saw where the cast decided if the Duke and Isabella got married depending on the audience reaction, so every night would end differently. Sometimes the Duke would beckon to Isabella to marry him, and sometimes she would go to him, and sometimes she would just stand there and, like non-verbally reject his proposal because it does completely come out of left field because she's so anti, you know, she's not, that's not what her character, that's like the antithesis of what her character is trying to achieve in this play. So,
see, that's the way I always read it. With her silence anyway, because she's such a vocal character that tries to use her voice to get her brother's freedom from Angelo, I always read her silence as, like, quiet indignation and refusal, because nothing is more powerful than the absence of voice in a spot where voice is expected. And I feel like that's because, you know, using her voice really didn't get her anywhere with Angelo. Her speeches are powerful and moving, and they move him to such emotion that, you know, he threatens her. And I think to have the complete opposite from a proposal that comes out of left field, I think maybe it was her testing, like, okay, using my voice to this extent didn't work. What happens if I don't use my voice? Because that's really the only option left for me at this juncture.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting idea. And the thing that I thought was the weirdest about the Duke's, like, random proposal at the end, aside from making him, it makes him feel kind of like an Angelo, just being like, all right, I think you're hot. But, I mean, at the beginning, she's, like, about to get, she's about to become a full-fledged nun. So she's, like, going to be a lifelong virgin. And then this guy's just like, by the way, we're going to get married now. And I was like, but that's, like, it's not like, you know, she was just trying to preserve her virginity because she wasn't married yet. It's also because she wanted to be a freaking nun. And now, like, she has to get married. It seems even worse because of that.
Yeah, and she doesn't have seven children to have musical numbers to her with, so, you know, she can't be the whole Fräulein, you know, Maria. Right.
Well, we might also want to take into context when this, you know, who this play was being originally performed to. I mean, it's Protestant England, and again, you know, nuns being more of a Catholic thing, they might have really kind of rejected the idea of a woman going into a convent and just giving up herself to the church like that.
That's interesting.
Oh, they can make the Catholic.
So, when exactly, do we know when-ish this play was written, like, in comparison to his others?
I'm glad you brought that up. What's kind of interesting is, with all these problem plays, they were written within a four-year period of each other. From 1600 through around 1604, we have actual probable dates of when these were performed. So, we see in 1601, or between 1600 and 1601 is Hamlet. 1601 to 1602 is Troilus and Cressida. 1602 to 1603 is All Is Well That Ends Well. And in probably around 1603 as well, we have, in 1604, we have Measure for Measure. And what it's actually very interesting timing for all those plays to kind of be performed, because this is the transition from the Elizabethan to the Jacobean period.
Yeah, that was the other thing I was going to ask is, that was, like, right around the end of Elizabeth's reign, right?
Mm-hmm. Right. So you have all of this period of incredible uncertainty and turmoil. I mean, who's going to be the next monarch? What's going to be the future of the English church? What's going to be the future of England? And so, basically, we have, you know, what we might want to see here is this idea of this cultural uncertainty being played out on the stage as well.
That's interesting.
Yeah, especially Measure for Measure, because the whole point of that is the Duke testing the waters with, you know, changing the political background.
Absolutely.
Well, I like that. And when was Macbeth? Because I know Macbeth was specifically written for James, right?
Well, again, Macbeth would have been probably written after November 5th, 1605.
Okay, so it was after the problem plays.
It makes that reference to the gunpowder plot.
Yeah.
So it would have been after that.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Cool. Good to know.
That's interesting, too, because that brings the concept of, like, as you mentioned, Tony, the failed manipulator of, like, the central character of all the plays. Kind of, if you put that in perspective of how Shakespeare felt during that time, not only manipulating the genre of each of his plays, but as the character, potentially, or kind of in the role of the manipulator, wondering if he failed, or, you know, seeing what would happen if the play didn't go in a conventional way for everybody. Mm-hmm.
Right, absolutely. I mean, it's, you know, this idea of the manipulator, that's something that you can see throughout a lot of Shakespeare's plays. So you can go back to, like, Richard III.
Yeah.
You know, we see Richard manipulating the whole political scene. We can almost see, like, this happening in Viola in Twelfth Night, you know, or in As You Like It.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have, here's Rosalind, who is the great manipulator there. So it's really kind of brilliant. But in, like, for example, if you go back to those two comedies, like in Twelfth Night and As You Like It, or even in Merchant of Venice, you know, with Portia, all these female characters, they're able to do this incredible manipulation and be very successful at it. And they're the ones that bring the plays to their proper conclusion. But in these plays, again, the manipulators don't do that. They fail at it.
So how does, let's talk about how the Duke then fails as manipulator.
I was going to ask that question too.
Well, I guess it's a question of the harmony he establishes at the end.
Okay.
You might want to think of the Duke in comparison to in Midsummer Night's Dream, Duke Thesian. Okay? Mm-hmm. You know, the marriage and that sort of ending harmony that we have in the end, it seems almost natural. I mean, he is the one who doesn't impose the marriage on them, but grants them the ability to do as they wish, right?
Yeah.
However, if you look, compare that to the marriages at the end of Measure for Measure, these are all, again, enforced marriages, and so it's, again, a question of, you know, what is the type of harmony that's at the end here? Is this a loving world that we're going to enter into now? Has true love triumphed?
Yeah, so actually, I don't remember this, even though I was, like, just rereading it the other day. Do Claudio and Juliet get permission to get married at the end of this play?
Yeah.
I think so. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so.
Okay, so we actually do have, like, one couple that wants to get married that gets to get married eventually.
Yeah. But they were pretty much already going to get married. It was it was Angelo that was preventing it.
Right. Yeah, and so that was actually another question I had was, why the heck, like, didn't they just let Claudio and Juliet get married and, like, circumvent the whole, like, we're going to cut his head off thing? I did
because
not understand.
Because then there wouldn't be a plot.
Yeah, exactly. That's a great point. There just wouldn't be a plot.
I love how contrived this whole play is. Like, everything Angela does, everything this Duke does makes no sense whatsoever, but it's to fulfill the plot and talk about the hypocrisy of, you know, free love versus, you know, Angelo, like, finds himself in the situation of hypocrisy. And then all the forced marriages at the end, it does kind of beg the question, and maybe this is also poking at Catholicism, like, you know, are these strict rules really going to make society function better? Like, if you're forcing people to get married just for the sake of, you know, upholding rules, is that really? It does pause, because now I'm remembering Shakespeare impregnated his wife before he married her, so I wonder
yep.
if this is Shakespeare making a commentary like, oh, I was forced to marry someone. I don't know.
Well, no,
yeah.
It could very well be, yeah. I mean, there's some evidence that suggests that Shakespeare was very much in love with his wife. You know, even before and after, but yeah, he basically went into, it was a shotgun wedding.
Yeah.
Know, for yeah.
Mm-hmm.
One of the other things in this play that feels like a problem to me, and it's one that kind of pops up in All's Well That Ends Well too, is this idea of Mariana, like, still wanting to be married to Angelo, even though he's a dickhead to her. And, like, going along with this plot to, like, pretend to be someone else while she sleeps with him, and then, like, Helena basically doing the same thing with Bertram and being like, well, he's been nothing but an ass to me, but, yeah, let's, like, do this switcheroo sex scene thing. Like, what the hell is that about?
Yeah.
That just feels very, like, I mean, and I guess it does happen, so I'm not going to say it's, like, not true to life, but, like, I would way rather Mariana be, like, a plucky Shakespeare heroine who's just, like, you know, says, sure, I'll do that, and then she gets into the situation and then she, like, makes fun of him the whole time and refuses to sleep with him and, like, runs off. That part of it, like, did not sit well with me, at least, like, for, like, a modern-day perspective.
Yeah, I think that's one of the difficulties in maybe translating these plays to modern time. Because absolutely, you're right, we have a woman, women who are pursuing men who are clearly do not love them, are verging on abusive with them. But in addition to that, though, I mean, you might kind of look at it a different way. Here's a woman who is pursuing what she wants, though.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and particularly even with Helena, I mean, I would look at her as almost a very strong female character, a protagonist. Probably one of the strongest ones he's ever written.
So is Helena like Bella Swan from Twilight pursuing what she wants?
I was thinking the same thing. Yes. somehow tricked Edward to sleeping with her. Yeah.
Okay.
I will give this pause if you look at it from a modern standpoint, though, is that if the genders were reversed and if it were men, like pretending to be someone else to sleep with a woman, I would be horrified at that. So the fact that we're not having this reaction of utter horror, because women don't really have power in this universe, so we're kind of looking at it as like, oh, you know, they're getting what they want, but at the same time, they're doing something extremely manipulative and duplicitous. And even though, you know, I have to admire Helena, at the same time, it does sort of creep me out.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
It's
verging on rape.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
That's what I was going to say.
Yeah, because the whole time we're so concerned about Isabella with Angelo because we don't want her to get raped by him. But at the same time, you know, did Angelo really consent to having sex with Mariana?
Yeah, that's a good point. I also had that thought that's actually kind of creepy. As far as Measure for Measure goes, this Pompey elbow subplot, and what's his face, the other prisoner, I don't remember his name.
Barbadine or something.
Yeah, that guy.
Barbadine.
Yeah.
Are they just there for like comedic subplot purposes?
Yeah, and you kind of see that with Shakespeare's later plays. I mean, you get that in Macbeth. You get that with the gatekeeper, or you know, in all the Henriette plays. You get that with Falstaff. So you always have this element of the comedic or lower class world.
Mm-hmm. It just felt more pointless in this play than it does in those other plays to me.
Why so?
I wasn't as like charmed by their banter, so I just like didn't care as much. That might be part of it. But I remember like when Pompey and Elbow came on and they were like trying to say what happened and they kept interrupting each other. I was just like, you guys are stupid. So, I don't know, it felt more like a plot filler than it does a lot of the time to me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Like, for this and for Troilus and Cressida, like, what's his face? Thersites?
Yep.
Like, they were just kind of there to, like, be funny for a couple scenes so that the play would be proper length. And I was like, okay.
Well, when you have all this problematic and complex manipulation plots going on, you know, I don't think Shakespeare's, you know, the lay people standing out in the crowd amongst piles of shit, I don't think they care about that. I think they want to see some stupid drunk people do stupid drunk things. That's true.
Well, yeah, they had to see somebody that they could identify with.
Okay, so does anyone else have anything else they want to say about Measure for Measure?
I just, like, this play, I love it, but it frustrates me so much at the same time because it just reminds me of sexist bullshit that I'm sick about even in modern-day society. And it's, like, just, like, this whole thing, I'm going to reference Disney movies because that's how I am. But, okay, The Hunchback of Notre Dame is my favorite Disney movie. And in that movie, we have, like, this whole thing with Frollo, like, you know, be mine or you will burn. And I feel like that's the same thing going on here with the treatment of woman, where it's just kind of like the virgin and whore dichotomy. Like, either you're a virgin or either you're a whore, and there's no in-between. Like, even Juliet, who is just eloping with the man she loves, is labeled a whore, and the person she had consensual sex with is pegged to die, whereas you have these men who are, like, trying to force themselves on, you know, virginal woman, and it's like, well, but then she'll, like, you know, it's her fault, like, just this whole, like, you have to, just something that, like, infuriates me, and it's still relevant, like, hundreds of years later.
Yeah, it makes me sad that we haven't really evolved very much.
So I got a question.
Okay.
Who's the modern-day equivalent of Angelo?
Like, all politicians who sleep with whoever the F they want.
Well, that's the thing. Like, yeah, like, I would say a politician that's, like, very much, like, you know, damning woman for, you know, having control of their own bodies, like, is anti-birth control, is like, you have to, you know, if you get knocked up, you have to take control of that baby, and you have to get married, and, like, if you have premarital sex, you'll die. Like, you know, very much like Mean Girls, but then is going around and, you know, knocking up his intern or secretary or something. It's like, oh, yeah. But, you know, it's okay if I do it.
Yeah, so I think, you know, for me, I always felt the play does have a lot of resonance politically, you know, when we try to combine that morality and politics and the hypocrisy that kind of just is produced by that.
Mm-hmm. And the other thing I think is kind of interesting is the Duke stepping down from his position for a little while to, like, I don't, like, because he says, oh, you know, I've been lenient for too long, so I can't all of a sudden put laws into place or whatever. And why does he choose Angelo to take his place?
I think because he's known for his cold, hard logic, perhaps.
Yeah.
So yeah, he'll
and Angelo's in a position that he can. He's politically, he's able to do this.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, it's like good cop, bad cop. Like, the Duke, I feel, still wants to be, like you said, he wants to provide that harmony and kind of come back in and be the hero. So I feel like he wants to pick someone who maybe subconsciously the people will hate, so he can come back in and save the day.
Yeah, that was something I thought was kind of interesting about the Duke when he says, well, you know, I don't like being in the spotlight, but then I'm going to stay here the whole time and, like, still try to make everyone do what I want.
Also, like, no one recognizes him. He puts on, like, 15 different costumes, and everyone's okay with it.
Well, that's every Shakespeare play. That's true.
Can you guys just imagine if, like, Barack Obama, like, stepped down from office for a week and then, like, dressed up in a costume and was, like, going around trying to talk to people?
So are you saying Joe Biden would step into Angelo's position?
Yes. I don't think Joe Biden would be much of an Angelo, though.
No, it's whoever they get to replace Boehner.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, I was going to say, Biden would be more like, you know, the elbow or whatever. I love him, okay, but he's kind of goofy.
Okay, one thing we haven't touched upon the Duke, that, like, because we're talking about how much of a hypocrite that Angelo is, but Lucio mentions, like, several times he tries to insinuate that the Duke is also, like, having, like, you know, affairs outside of marriage and stuff like that. And so that's something that's never really proven, but it's just kind of interesting for me. Like, can we really think of the Duke as the protagonist of this play?
I guess I always thought Isabella as the protagonist.
Yeah. Well, that's how I feel, but...
It'd be nice if Isabella had a little more screen time.
Mm-hmm.
I think.
Yeah.
If she's supposed to be one of those comedic heroines. Yeah, I think that's a good point, though. Like, the Duke gets mad at Lucio for saying the things he's saying, but then he doesn't necessarily say, like, oh, I never did that. He's just kind of like, you're a jerk, you know? So maybe, like, he can't deny it. All of it, anyway.
Like, it just goes back to what Tony was talking about politicians, where it's like, these are the people that are making these rules, but if these rules are pretty much broken by everyone, including the people that legislate them, what does that say about the society that, you know, the state of the society those rules are being administered in?
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, in some ways, I would just call Angelo as a type of Puritan.
Yeah.
Yeah, and this would have been Shakespeare kind of imagining what it would have been like if the Puritan did take over the church and over the monarchy. I mean, we kind of see that what happens when Cromwell takes over England later on in the century.
Yeah, so it's kind of like since we know Shakespeare does not like Puritans, him kind of pointing out, like, their hypocrisy. And I was just really quick, Katie, when you compared this to the Hunchback of Notre Dame, I actually thought it was a good comparison because you have this, like, serious plot going on and, like, the ruler who's, like, cracking down on everyone and being, like, a total dick. And then you have the gargoyles acting as, like, the totally random comedic relief that, like, maybe shouldn't even be in there.
No, I think it is a really big comparison, but it's just also something that, like, it's a constant reminder of this, you know, virgin war dichotomy to me that hasn't completely gone away. Like, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I think Isabella should definitely reject the Duke, personally.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I agree. It's not, like, with all the other romances, except for, you know, most of the ones, although I would have the Winter's Tale as well. I think the Winter's Tale could also be a problem play, but that's a whole other spiel. But, like, you know, I'm not rooting for the Duke and Isabella. I'm not rooting for Bertram and Helena. You know, I'm not rooting for Troyus and Cressida, so what kind of resolution does that leave us?
It doesn't leave us a resolution. We got to play without a resolution.
Yeah.
People don't like that.
It's really
unfortunate. That's why they're called problem plays.
Do you want to move on to All's Well That Ends Well?
Sure.
Yeah.
All right. So, I mean, I guess as we were talking about correct me if I'm wrong, but the kind of sticking point for this one for a lot of people is that Helena keeps pursuing Bertram even though he's not interested at all, which doesn't seem to make much sense. And then at the end, he's like, oh, okay, yeah, I love you, we'll be married. And you're like, where did that come from?
Because he has to.
Mm-hmm. Well, it kind of reminds me of Demetrius from Midsommar, because it's like, I know we're supposed to, like, expect that. We know that Demetrius was in love with Helena at one point, so them kind of getting back together gets a little easier with the audience, but it's one of those things where, you know, it's the woman pursuing the guy, and at the end, the resolution's kind of forced, and it doesn't quite fit.
Uh-huh.
And they're both named Helena. What is this Shakespeare? And these repeat names, like Helen Smith. I know. And then you always have some brother named Antonio. Like, it's
Yeah,
he's not Antonio.
His Helenas and his Antonios.
There's definitely some context there, in some way.
Yeah, but the difference here is that there is no magic love potion. Like, in the end of Midsummer, even though the consent there is kind of dubious as well, it's like, okay, at least, you know, Demetrius is under some love potion, so he might really love Helena. I don't know. Whereas here, it's like, okay, no, he clearly does not love Helena.
So, just a question for everybody. Like, on a scale of which kind of forced marriage is more unsettling, is it worse if, I mean, probably that's the case, but is it worse if you see a woman pursuing a guy and then they have to get together, or if you see a guy pursuing a woman and then they have to get together?
Well, I think, you know, as a woman, and it's a very real fear in these plays, is that, you know, a woman who is forced into a relationship, her biggest fear is being, you know, raped or killed. Like, you know, Isabel even says for her, it would be worse, you know, to lose her virginity, essentially being raped. I think for a woman, you know, that can be a fear that is more poignant than death. Whereas if a man is forced into a marriage, you know, I think, his wife's probably not going to kill him. She's probably not going to, you know, use force against him. I'm just speaking from as a woman and what the fears of being a woman are here.
Yeah.
No, I agree. That's how I take it personally, like on a personal context too.
What I was going to say is that, like, for this time period, if the woman is forced into the marriage, like if Isabel and the Duke get married because he said so, then she basically has to be the dutiful wife, or he could, you know, have her killed if he wanted to. If a man is forced into a marriage, like, yeah, he might have a wife and a couple kids tying him down, but in that time period, he could go around and, like have sex basically with whoever he wants outside of marriage, and he won't really get in trouble for it.
Yeah, unless his wife is a very unusual woman, but I don't think Helen is that kind of woman. Like, neither situation is good, obviously, but... Okay, this is kind of a random point, but I just want to point out that the name of the play, All's Well That Ends Well, is kind of a play on words. So, literally, the resolution of the only thing that allows the ending to happen is Helena getting pregnant. And so, if you take the S at the end of ends and move that to well, All's Well That Ends Well, that is literally the only thing that I think forces, because that's the thing, we're talking about, like, forced marriages, but I don't think Gertrude would have been forced into that marriage had Helena not gotten pregnant, so I think that's the only thing that allows the resolution to happen, which, again, makes it very unusual than the other Shakespeare plays. This is the only one the only romance, I think, that ends in a pregnancy.
Oh, that's a good point, that she actually gets pregnant.
Mm-hmm. Well, we can actually kind of compare it to the previous one, Measure for Measure, where it begins with a pregnancy.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That was something I actually thought about both of those plays. I was like, are these problem plays because women are getting pregnant? People are uncomfortable with that.
So problematic.
The other thing about All's Well That Ends Well, that, like, just that phrase, is it's like, well, if it ends up okay in the end, then everything's cool, even if it was, like, totally screwed up the whole way to get to that ending. It's just, it's a very, looking at the end and saying, well, is it the ends justify the means sort of approach of,
yeah,
if it ended up okay, then who cares how we got there?
Right.
Yeah.
Well, there's actually Helen has a great quote here. It's actually in Act 4, Scene 4, where she says, "All's well that ends well still defines the crown, and whatever course the end is the renown." So it's the ends justify the means.
Yeah.
So it doesn't matter how we get to the end, as long as we get there. You know, the ends justify the means.
So is that a commentary on the play itself? Shakespeare's saying, it doesn't matter how we get to the end, as long as we get to the end.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, but then you can deconstruct that and say, well, does that make the best play? Because I think as an audience, I think the action of how you get there is more what makes the play entertaining than the end itself. Although, you can't have an upset ending, but I think, the middle is where the juice is, and I think that's Shakespeare playing around with it and saying, like, you all want a happy ending so much, like, how much are you willing to spend your disbelief, I guess?
Well, then that begs the question, okay, if we go back to, again, Midsummer Night's Dream, where we know that Demetrius still has this charm on his eyes that's making him fall in love with Helen despite his, his true love, despite his will. We're okay with that, or are we okay with that? And we question more of the end with All's Well That Ends Well, where Bertram is forced to be with Helen.
And I actually read an interesting point when I was reading up on this one that some productions will have, like, Bertram agree to marry Helena, and say his line about, I'll love you and be your husband or whatever. But then when he, like, faces the audience, you can totally see in his face, like, I just did that so that the king wouldn't, have me killed or whatever. And he's actually not into it still.
Oh, so it's just like Measure for Measure.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Except just like a role reversal, basically.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Or a gender flop.
Yeah. But do we like Helena better than the Duke? Like, in this case, you know, it's the role reversal, but if we like Helena more than Bertram, then it's not so much that you feel bad for Bertram, you're just like, Helena, like, stop trying to marry this guy that's not good enough for you.
Yeah, but I guess we're also putting our modern standpoint on it, where, you know, Helena might not have had very many options, and, you know, she's clearly an ambitious girl, she knows medicine, and she probably doesn't want to marry someone, you know, who she considers beneath her or who won't challenge her. She wants to marry, you know, someone in nobility. So I really see it as the story of a really ambitious woman who wants to marry above herself, and she just happens to be in love with the person she wants to marry. I can't say whether I think she has some admirable qualities. In other ways, I think she's crazy, but, I think that's us kind of projecting our modern standpoint as if she had other options. Like, we're saying, oh, she should finally get the other guy as if she had other options, but she probably really didn't.
Oh, you don't like Parole?
Yeah, exactly. I think she would be Bertram in that situation. She wouldn't want to marry someone she considered beneath her.
Sorry, thank you. I was going to say, that raises another interesting point about character, and it's not just, well, do the ends justify the means, but does the character justify the means? If a character that was portrayed as less likable did the same thing, would we still root for them or hate them or not approve of their actions?
Yeah, so the more we like a character, the more we're willing to overlook any of the kind of off-putting things that they're doing.
Well, yeah, I mean, we get that in again, I think a good comparison there, then, is Richard III.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we like that his character. He's charismatic. He's funny. As he slaughters his entire family to get to the crown.
Right. Or even, Iago is more of, like, I don't know if he's as likable as Richard, but he kind of has his own weird charm, even though he's trying to totally screw over Othello. So, maybe if Helena was, like, more of the Magnificent Bastard character.
I'd be down with that. It certainly would be more entertaining that way.
Hmm. So, she would be more entertaining if she was more conniving or more like a Iago?
Yeah.
I think
I like that. That would work for me.
I think it's for modern audiences, yeah.
Mm.
I was going to say, I don't know whether Shakespeare's contemporary audience would have, like, it really depends on, like, I wonder how they perceive Lady Macbeth. I mean, she's obviously a great villain, but, like, I just wonder if they would have reveled in such a nasty female character.
Yeah, one of the things I was going to say is that Richard III and Iago both, like, do that, you know, breaking the fourth wall thing where they talk directly to the audience that modern-day people love. I'm thinking of, like, so many people love House of Cards, and, like, the main character on that show does that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. If Shakespeare utilized that sort of device with her, where... Because Lady Macbeth... doesn't get to kind of do that, like, wink at the audience thing. She's just, you know, going about her business like the people on stage and not aware of who she's playing to necessarily in the audience. But if Helena was, like, conniving and self-aware of, like, the meta nature of the play. But I agree, like Shakespeare's audience might not like that, but I would like that.
Yeah, I would like that.
I would like that. For sure.
Okay, let's move on to Troilus and Cressida so we don't run over our allotted time.
Yeah, I think this is one of Shakespeare's weakest plays, I'm not gonna lie.
Troilus and Cressida?
Yeah.
So I had never actually read this before we said we were gonna do it for this podcast, which was good, because, like, I want to read all of his plays. And I was really surprised that Troilus and Cressida is basically, like, the Iliad in play form.
Yeah.
I was not expecting that.
In that case, just read the original.
Yeah. So, like, why did he call this Troilus and Cressida if they're, like, such a small part of it?
Well, he probably was... Well, he's taking the plot from Chaucer, where Chaucer wrote a long poem, Troilus and Cressida. And so that was... We think that's Shakespeare's source for it. And his audience would have recognized it.
Okay. So that's more of, like, a thing that would confuse a modern audience, but not... Not people
right.
in his
and,
time.
And also, we think that this play was originally written for the inns of courts, you know, where the lawyers were being trained.
Mm-hmm.
So, since they would have been more knowledgeable about the classic, they would have really recognized this and would have wanted something like this.
Okay. So, here's, again, I, like, poked around and did a little bit of reading on it, because I wanted to, like, try to understand why all of them were problem plays. And one of the things I was reading about Troilus and Cressida said that in the case of this play, like, the tone shifts don't seem to work as well.
Mm-hmm.
From, like, the yeah. super serious, like, classical to, like, the bantery stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of throws people, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
But... Mm-hmm. Joyce Carol Oates, of all people, had this, like, really interesting quote where she argued, like, this was one of his most modern plays. Like, most contemporary feeling. And I'm trying to remember why she said that. So I guess that's not very helpful.
Would it be because it doesn't easily fit into either a history, a tragedy, or a comedy, or romance, that we have so many mixed elements of all of those in here?
Yeah, and I think it was, like the ambiguity and the,
mm-hmm.
yeah, just, like, that lack of, I can totally Google it while I am talking to you guys.
Cheating!
Do you mean modern in today's times or for Shakespeare's contemporary?
For us, so... So several characteristic elements of the play, the most notable being its constant questioning of intrinsic values such as hierarchy, honor, and love, have often been viewed as distinctly modern. So Joyce Carol Oates said, Troilus and Cressida, that most vexing and ambiguous of Shakespeare's plays, strikes the modern reader as a contemporary document. Its investigation of numerous infidelities, its criticism of tragic pretensions... Above all, its implicit debate between what is essential in human life and what is only existential are themes of the 20th century. This is tragedy of a special sort. The tragedy, the basis of which is the impossibility of conventional tragedy.
Well then that speaks to the whole essence of a problem play, doesn't it? I mean, is the reason why we talk about these as problem plays, is the reason why we kind of maybe don't see these plays performed as much, is because they don't fit into easily into any of these genres, because they don't give us the ending that we want? Is this one of the reasons why we kind of reject them?
I think that's a very strong possibility.
Yeah, but I also agree with Gab in that, unlike All's Well in Measure for Measure, I feel like the transitions in Troilus and Cressida just aren't seamless. Like, I feel like one of my pet peeves in characterization is when characters act a certain way to fulfill plot points that aren't necessarily in character, and I feel like you have a lot of that going on here, where Cressida's transformation is completely unexplained. It just comes out of nowhere to fulfill kind of, you know, the self-fulfilling prophecy that we know is going to happen, because audiences would have been familiar with the story of Troilus and Cressida, and we know she turns on him, so of course she has to, but it's not in a way that is satisfying. So I'm not just talking, you know, I think the problem plays all have strange endings, but here I was unsatisfied with all of the action, because I feel like there are so many characters from the Iliad, you know, being, you know, reimagined here. I'm not satisfied with their characterization, except for maybe Ulysses. And it just, like, there's just no, I don't grow to care enough about these characters. I don't grow to care enough about Troilus and Cressida to care about their tragic resolution. So I think I agree with Gats here in that there's kind of a failure to transition seamlessly.
Also, the scene where Troilus leaves Cressida after they sleep together, I was just like, this is Romeo and Juliet. He's copying himself.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
So one of the things, Olivia, I think you mentioned this before we started recording. One of the kind of interesting things Troilus and Cressida brings up, though, is like this Achilles Patrocles thing.
Hmm. Oh, yeah.
And I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, everyone, but isn't the rumor that they were like possibly lovers in addition to being friends? That was kind of a thing. Like, that's been a thing throughout history, right? Like, people have always talked about that. Well,
So Thersites actually calls Patroclus Achilles' man whore at one point.
Yeah.
The thing is, back then, they didn't necessarily have a conception of being, like, of being gay. Like, male-on-male relations were a thing, but there was no such thing as, like, sexual orientation. I'm probably not explaining myself well, so something like that would have been accepted as a part of history. Like, oh, yeah, Achilles had, you know, this man whore, but he's also, you know, flirting with a princess. Like, that's just kind of an accepted convention because people couldn't really even comprehend that male romance was a thing.
Yeah.
Right. And actually, what's kind of, you know, just to, you know, piggyback on that a little bit, it's kind of interesting that with Achilles, when he is very much about, excuse me, I forget the name of the woman he's kind of in love with. What's her name?
Briseis?
Thank you, Chris. He's actually accused that relationship makes him more effeminate.
Mm-hmm.
And that his relationship with Patroclus is actually more affirming of his own masculinity.
Well, that was the conception throughout, for, like, the Greeks throughout time. It was, you know, older men would take younger male lovers to kind of not train them sexually, but to elevate their mind. Male-male relationships were seen as, like, intellectual and interesting, and that male-female relationships were base and carnal and used for reproduction.
Yeah. And if you were, like, a ladies' man, then that actually made you, like, more girly in a lot of people's eyes because you were, like, spending so much time with the ladies. Which is just, like, it's interesting because it's, like, the opposite, kind of today. And I was just thinking, like, one of the interesting things about that for me, about, like, Achilles, is that even though, like, in the past they would have had no concept of, like, Achilles is gay, that's, like, totally a modern thing. But, like, in the modern eyes, I was like, it's kind of interesting that, like, if we view Achilles as gay, or maybe bisexual, that he's, like, the manliest warrior of all time. And I just, like, love how that breaks, like, convention.
Yeah. Although today's kind of evolving into the whole bromance thing. Like, you know, if you have, like, a bunch of frat boys that, like, you know, like, you're my bro. Like, it's kind of, like, that's kind of what it's become today, I guess.
That Achilles and Patroclus would be bros.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, what was that? The movie Troy.
Yeah.
You know, Brad Pitt.
Right.
They totally heterosexualized relationship between Achilles and Patroclus.
They did.
Yeah.
They were just like, they're friends, they're cousins, love with this chick. It's like, BS. Anything else about problem plays?
I think they should be performed more. One of my favorite productions ever was All's Well That Ends Well. I think there's some really wonderful comedic moments in there. And it does such a great spin on, you know, how Helen is this more empowered character. And it allows us to question her actions, too.
Yeah. Yeah, I actually was kind of thinking that, too. It's interesting, like, what everyone has to read for school, and so there becomes, like, a very specific, narrow set of Shakespeare plays that everyone knows. So, you know, the 20th time you see Hamlet, you're kind of like, oh, this isn't super fresh anymore. I actually think reading Hamlet occasionally feels like reading a series of famous quotes, because we say so much of the crap from that play. But these plays, like, are all basically brand new, so I think that's an interesting point that they would be very new to people.
Well, do you think that one of the ways to really appreciate these plays, you have to have more of an understanding of Shakespeare?
I think it definitely helped to have more of an understanding of Shakespeare. I think it definitely helped influence how you read the plays. And I was just going to say that I agree with Tony and that I think these plays should be performed more because I think there's more opportunity for interpretation here. And I just always find it interesting. Like, I've only seen one performance of Measure for Measure. I've only seen one performance of all of these, but I've heard of, you know, again, of how, you know, like, at the end where some performances have Isabel reject the Duke or where Bertram rejects Helena. I think there's a lot of open space for alternate interpretation here that I'd be interested to see.
Yeah. Yeah, getting to see people play with it as much as they play with the other ones. I just wanted to say, Tony, thank you for agreeing to call in and be a guest on this show.
Well, thank you for having me.
I always like you schooling me a little bit, so.
I'm sorry, what?
I always like you teaching me.
Well, I try.
I appreciate it.
But you teach me, too.
So that's kind of all we have for today. If anyone has any comments about these three plays, you think we are stupid and missed something, or you just want to throw your 2 cents in, feel free to add to the conversation on our website, www.minervamag.com. You can also find us on Facebook, or you can tweet at us at magminerva. And we also have a Tumblr, so we're all over social media. And I don't believe we know exactly what we're doing for next time, so that'll just be a surprise for everyone. Just a reminder that Minerva updates podcasts every week on Thursdays, so you can go check out our other podcasts as well. Novel Ideas, a couple episodes of those, that actually features Tony talking about Shakespeare some more, if anyone wants more Shakespeare talk. And I think with that, we're going to sign off, so bye, everyone.